this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Survivor, Private College Edition, Depleted Endowments, Rising Tuition Plague North Carolina Institutions. And that's the headline on the front page. Inside, the article actually begins with another headline, Higher Ed's Math Problem. In a sector brimming with statistics, the demographic and financial numbers simply don't add up for a growing number of colleges and universities in North Carolina. And this article is written by Sarah Headley. It was an early spring morning on March 3, 2015, when the decision was announced. Sweetbriar College, a Tony private school tucked in the mountains of central Virginia, was closing because of financial difficulties. There was such a gasp. I checked my watch because I thought it was April Fool's Day, but it wasn't. It was just Tuesday, recalls Becca Silustri, a Sweetbriar sophomore at the time, who soon after transferred to the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee. The email about the closure was very cold. It was very straight to the point, says Sweetbriar senior and Raleigh native Charlotte Barber. We never got a lot of info. You never think that your college will close, especially not when you're attending it. And yet, in the next few years, there could be several private colleges in North Carolina that could face the same predicament unless something changes and changes fast. While thanks to some 7,000 gifts and pledges, raising $13 million that has allowed Sweetbriar to remain open for now, the long-term math of higher education at private colleges shows a lot of red and fewer available capital resources. So are these private colleges that rely on endowments in order to subsidize student costs in trouble? Moody's Investor Service, the credit rating agency, released a report in late 2015 forecasting the rise in small private and public college foreclosures and mergers. Though the rise only accounts for 1% of all colleges, it still covers thousands of students, faculty, and support staff. Couple that with the recent Gallup survey where 56% of polled business officers in higher education noted that there is a financial crisis looming over higher education. If one pairs off the colleges funded by public dollars in North Carolina, there are scores of private colleges all across the state that rely on endowments and tuition to fund operations. Endowments have taken big hits in recent years, although the latest cycle of endowment returns have blunted the hurt for many colleges in the last fiscal year. But with a volatile Wall Street wiping out trillions from the market caps of companies and the net worth of their executives, could the private colleges of North Carolina survive another onslaught from a down economy? The answer lies in size, as in size matters. We look at their dependency on tuition to see if they have alternative sources of revenue that can offset the pressure to continue to increase their tuition cost, says Jim Ratchford, an accountant with Cherry Bakert, who also is the industry leader of the firm's education group. Liquidity. That's kind of the buzzword for the rating agencies looking at private colleges these days, Ratchford says. A plague on private colleges. Rating agencies look at the institutions to see if they are generating enough cash from operations and their investment income to adequately fund ongoing operations. A 2012 report by Bain & Company detailed the direction in which the financial sustainability of U.S. colleges is moving by looking at each institution's expense ratio, expenses as a percentage of revenue, and equity ratio, equity as a percentage of assets. It found the equity ratio at some institutions was down while the expense ratio was up. Bain's analysis does not holistically state the financial status of higher ed institutions. Rather, it measures whether these institutions were moving toward a more sustainable financial future or toward a less sustainable one between 2007 and 2012. In North Carolina, 17 private colleges were in the red zone during that five-year period, meaning they were on an unstable financial path. This list includes both big and small schools, but larger institutions can withstand tough financial periods because of higher endowments and higher enrollments. The Bain report notes, a plague facing modern-day colleges, modern-day private colleges, is the need to differentiate one institution from another. In turn, some colleges fall victim to expanding too quickly across numerous spectrums instead of strengthening their core. The core is overshadowed by the want to diversify, which can lead to broad investments and smaller returns on investment. But the worst-case scenario for an institution is to be relatively expensive and completely undifferentiated, according to Bain authors. Who will pay $40,000 per year to go to a school that is completely undistinguished on any dimension? Hope Williams, president of the North Carolina Independent Colleges and Universities, NCICU, the professional group that represents some 36 private colleges in the Tar Heel State, echoes similar sentiments and says private institutions in the state are aware of this challenge and they work to distinguish themselves without spreading too thin. The financial well-being of all of these colleges are relevant to every North Carolinian. An NCICU economic analysis shows that these colleges produced $14.2 billion in economic benefit to North Carolina in 2013, accounting for 3.2% of the state's gross domestic product. But to keeping these colleges healthy is getting harder with every passing year, especially if endowment levels refuse to budge northward and colleges are handcuffed with higher tuition fees. Balancing endowments and tuition. According to federal data, nearly a dozen of the 36 NCICU institutions had less than $15,000 in endowment assets per full-time enrolled student. Colleges such as Gardner-Webb University in Boiling Springs allots about $13,462 per full-time equivalent FTE enrollment, and its endowment stands just shy of $63 million. On the other hand, Johnson C. Smith University, for example, whose endowment assets were similar to those of Gardner-Webb, has $42,745 per FTE enrollment, nearly $30,000 more than its private counterpart. Other private colleges have vastly different models. High Point University brings in 84% of its core revenue from tuition and fees. It has an endowment of more than $48 million, but just $11,699 in endowment assets per FTE enrollment. The university, with more than 4,300 enrolled, has been lauded by its students for its grand amenities. The past 10 years have been a time of growth for HPU, in which it added four academic schools and tripled its enrollment. High Point's president, Nido Quibin, is also the third highest paid university president in the U.S., raking in $2.9 million in 2013, according to a Chronicle of Higher Education report. And then there's Duke University, with an endowment of more than $7.3 billion. Duke has about $388,000 per FTE enrollment. It continues to rank in the top 10 colleges in U.S. World News and Report, and has the nation's 15th largest endowment according to the National Association of College and University Business Officers, NACUBO. For fiscal year 2014, Duke's rate of return on investment was 20.1%, though the rate of return was only 4.4% for fiscal year 2015, Duke aims to have an annualized real rate of return of at least 5% net of fees, and it continuously hits that mark, according to its investment organization, DUMAC. Duke's public counterparts, UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University, posted market value changes of 13.2% and 15% respectively on their endowments in 2014. Elon's market value change on its more than $189 million endowment outweighed Duke at 22%. Larger private universities like Duke and Davidson College can withstand financial pressures as they also benefit from substantial endowments and higher enrollments. Smaller private institutions like Laurel University and High Point, with a minuscule endowment of $1.1 million, have fewer choices. Laurel allots a mere $4,114 per full-time student, and its tuition and fees amount to 71% of its core revenue. Livingstone College, a small, historically black college in Salisbury, had an endowment of $2.7 million in 2014. The The college is currently underway in its five-year fundraising campaign, with hope set on raising $25 million. If the lofty goal is met, its endowment will be more than 10 times its current size. Not surprisingly, Duke and Wake Forest University have the lowest percentage of core revenues derived from tuition and fees, with only 11 and 18%, respectively. Davidson comes in a close third with 20%. In all, about 15 of the state's private institutions gather 70% or more of their core revenues from tuition and fees. Those colleges include ones like High Point University at 84%, Elon University at 78%, and Gardner-Webb at 71%. Financial aid. Colleges are struggling to strike the balance between affordability and bringing in enough tuition revenue. The U.S. Department of Education projects that the total number of high school graduates will decrease by 2% by 2022 to 2023. A smaller number of high school graduates means private colleges feel pressure to differentiate themselves from other similar institutions. Often, financial aid packages become the differentiator. Administrators note colleges would rather have students paying discounted rates than not having them enrolled at all. For NCICU's Williams, ensuring each student finds the right collegiate fit and is able to afford it is a top priority. In fiscal year 2013, NCICU colleges were responsible for $580 million in institutional aid. Additionally, almost one-third of all students attending those colleges were eligible to receive Pell Grants from the federal government. Some North Carolina colleges offer a large number of their full-time undergraduate students some form of financial aid. For example, at Livingstone, 97.2% of its undergraduates receive some form of aid. At Salem College, the number jumps to 100%. Salem's aid averages around $15,559 per student, helping to foot the $37,000 bill for tuition fees, room, and board. The financial picture for hundreds of private colleges may soon reach the dire stage because of what many say is supply and demand. There are fewer high school students applying to private colleges as the cost of higher education reaches new heights. At the same time, private colleges, in order to differentiate themselves from others, are introducing new programs and hiring new facility, but are often forced to maintain the traditional degree programs. Williams says it is a different picture in the Tar Heel State. While high school graduates are decreasing in the Northeast, the South's graduates are projected to increase 9% by fiscal year 2023. When Williams joined NCICU in 1986, she says North Carolina had just over 46,000 undergraduates. Fall 2014 had more than 68,000 undergraduates and close to 21,000 in students enrolled in graduate programs. I do think we're fortunate in North Carolina because we have a very low out-migration rate for students to go out of state for college, she says. That's good news for the state's economy, especially since there is a strong proclivity to stay where one graduates from college, William adds. Family dilemma. For Celestri, financial aid played a major role in her decision to originally attend Sweetbriar. I'm not from a family where it's really viable to pay full tuition at a college like this, she says. The rolling hills of Sweetbriar's 3,250-acre campus, its small class sizes and supportive faculty have been the biggest draw for the students and their families. But sometimes stability outweighs love. That's why Celestri says she transferred. Just 2 hours after Celestri put her deposit down for the University of the South, the Supreme Court of Virginia overturned Sweetbriar's decision to close, after advocates said it went against the will upon which the college was founded. After the initial shutdown announcement, Sweetbriar promised to stay open one more year. But for then sophomores like Celestri, they would have to transfer to another institution to finish their senior year. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Former bank CEO honored in Clayton. Johnston Health Clayton's Chapel was recently renamed in honor of Aiden Lee, who served as president and CEO of Four Oaks Bank and Trust Company for 35 years. The chapel will be known as the Aiden R. and Betty J. Lee Chapel. Through the years, he and his wife Betty have faithfully supported the communities the bank serves, reads a plaque in the chapel. By their example, the couple has helped shape Four Oaks Bank and Trust into a company that invests in communities, believes in the potential of people, and embraces the business model of banking on relationships. The Lees are lifelong Clayton residents. Eshelman to receive CED Award. The Council for Entrepreneurial Development, CED, will award Fred Eshelman the Life Science Leadership Award at the 25th Annual CED Life Science Conference in March. As founder, CEO, and executive chairman of pharmaceutical research company, PPD, as well as founding chairman of drug developer, Furix Pharmaceuticals, Eshelman has played a pivotal role in the development of the North Carolina life science community, according to CED. His ventures helped him amass a small fortune, and he recently committed $100 million to the UNC Eshelman School of Pharmacy to help launch the next generation of drug discoverers. I appreciate CED's work with many of the breakthrough companies in North Carolina, and I am personally committed to the continued vibrancy of this region as a top life science cluster, Eshelman said. Montoyo tapped for Hall of Fame. Former Durham Bulls manager Charlie Montoyo will enter the International League Hall of Fame as a member of the 2016 class. In 8 years with the Bulls, Montoyo earned a 633-515 record, the most wins by a manager in franchise history. He led the organization to 7 South Division titles, a league record 6 Governor's Cup final berths, and 2 Governor's Cup titles in 2009 and 2013. Montoyo was named the International League Manager of the Year twice, in 2010 and 2013. A native of Manati, Puerto Rico, Montoyo is now the third base coach for the Tampa Bay Rays, the Bulls' major league affiliate. The Durham Bulls hold a special place in my heart, and I am looking forward to celebrating this honor with the Bulls and their fans, Montoyo said. Montoyo becomes the third Durham Bull to be inducted into the league's Hall of Fame, joining former Bulls manager Bill Evers and former pitcher Dave Island, who were both inducted in 2012. There is no one more deserving of this honor than Charlie Montoyo, said Bulls general manager Mike Burling. Hockey whiz kid headed to Finland. While the surname Rogers may be familiar to football fans, it's making waves in hockey as well. This Rogers hails from Apex and is only 12 years old. Hannah Rogers was selected at the International Selects Hockey Program's annual tryout held January 2 in Buffalo, New York. She will join the East Coast Selects hockey team. Rogers' family is quite involved in the town of Apex as well. In July 2015, her father and founder of Apex's Prime Mortgage Lending, John Rogers, donated $100,000 to the Apex skate park, now called Rogers Family Skate Plaza. Bruce Radford, Apex town manager at the time of the donation, can be very persuasive, John tells Biz. Hannah was one of about 225 girls from across North America competing for 68 positions on 4 teams. Those selected will participate in the program's International Spring Training Development Camp and the World Selects Invitational in Helsinki, Finland this April. Selects Hockey works with top 12 to 16-year-old hockey players across North America and Europe in an effort to facilitate opportunities at the prep school, NCAA, junior, and professional levels. Wanted: public displays of affection. Raleigh has a new kiss cam. The Flanders Gallery at 505 South Blunt Street is inviting couples to record their kisses on video as part of an interactive public art project called Public Display. The exhibit will project the public videos set to kiss-themed music alongside footage of the 22nd silent film produced in 1896 by the Thomas Edison Company, featuring the iconic kiss of May Irwin and John Rice. There's no cost to participate. Just show up at the gallery between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. on First Friday, February 5, and from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Valentine's Day, Sunday, February 14. Artists for the installation include Louis Cherry, Marsha Gordon, Jason Paul Evans Groth, Josephine McRobbie, and Trevor Thornton. And finally, in a section called The Hype, Triangle Cities make headlines in recent national rankings. Number one, Duke University graduates earn more over the long term than graduates of any other North Carolina college. That's from Georgetown University. Number four, Durham's rank on global list of most VC funding per capita. Richard, Florida, Martin Prosperity Institute. Number five, Raleigh Cary's rank among most educated metros in the U.S., according to Headlight. And number five, Raleigh Cary's rank among best metros for middle-class families, according to Chapman University. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Publix on a roll in Cary. Plans for a new Publix-anchored shopping center in West Cary that's been opposed by some neighbors will move to the next step after receiving a strong endorsement from a town-appointed planning and zoning board on January 25. The Sembler Company of St. Petersburg, Florida, along with the property owners of the land at the northwest corner of Green Level Church Road and Carpenter Fire Station Roads, Peggy and Grover Luter of Cary, have filed a request with the town seeking a comprehensive plan amendment and rezoning for the 22-acre site. More than a dozen neighbors, mostly from the Arlington Park neighborhood, which backs up to the proposed Amberley Village Retail Center, spoke out against the project at the meeting. Raleigh attorney Ben Kuhn, who is representing the neighborhood group, argues that a change to the comprehensive plan to allow high-density retail adjacent to an existing single-family home neighborhood in Cary would set a new precedent for the town and would have a negative impact on the neighborhood. Part of the developer's requirement is they show a demonstrated need to allow for this particular type of development, Kuhn says. And while Southeast Raleigh would be considered a food desert, this part of Cary would be considered a food oasis for all the grocery stores it has. Cary's Planning and Zoning Board voted 7-1 to approve the Publix developer's request for the comprehensive plan amendment, the first step in the approvals process. Board member Nancy Coggia, a Cary real estate agent, was the lone dissenting vote. The board's recommendation will be sent to the Cary Town Council for discussion next. The rezoning case is tentatively scheduled to be heard by the Planning and Zoning Board March 21. Sembler is planning to develop a non-traditional 110,000-square-foot retail shopping center called Amberley Village, which would be anchored by a 49,000-square-foot Publix grocery store. Publix confirmed those plans on January 20, the grocery chain's fifth proposed store in the Triangle. Sembler spokesman Mike Trainer says the company is trying to work with the residents of Amberley to solicit more feedback. In fact, we have hosted three well-attended neighborhood meetings, and we have made significant changes to our plans based on homeowner feedback, Trainer says. We look forward to continuing this process. A developer of a similarly sized Publix-anchored grocery store near the Bedford at Falls River community in North Raleigh had faced a similar battle in 2014 and 2015 with an organized group of neighbors opposed to its new shopping center plan. The developer of that site eventually withdrew the petition. Triangle area hotels dominate in AAA Diamond Awards in North Carolina. Two out of three North Carolina properties earning AAA Carolina's prestigious Five Diamond Awards for 2016 are in the Triangle, including the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary and the Farrington House Inn in Pittsboro. Both held on to their Five Diamond Hotel ratings for another year. The Ritz-Carlton in Charlotte is the only other North Carolina property earning Five Diamond status. The Umstead's Heron's Restaurant and Farrington's Farrington House Restaurant also held on to their Five Diamond ratings in the AAA's restaurant category. Earning four Diamond Hotel awards in the Triangle were the Renaissance Hotel at North Hills in Raleigh, the King's Daughters Inn, Arrowhead Bed and Breakfast, and Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club, all in Durham, the Siena Hotel and Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill, and Holly Inn and the Carolina Hotel in Pinehurst. New deal in play for Cameron Village drugstore site. The owners of the Cameron Village Shopping Center in Raleigh are foregoing plans to demolish and redevelop the retail building site that the Rite Aid drugstore has occupied for years in favor of a new deal. The new agreement locks the pharmacy store into a 20-year contract and will open up new space for a big new retailer to come in. The Rite Aid store will be moving to the downstairs level of the building on Woodburn Road following a nearly $5 million renovation that is already underway. The space had previously served as the office headquarters of York Properties, the Raleigh-based real estate firm whose predecessor company built Cameron Village in 1948. Renovations to the building will include a new exterior look using historic bricks from a demolished mill building in Indiana that will complement the nearby two-story brick Chick-fil-A restaurant. Negotiations with a potential retailer for the 25,000 square foot space on the top floor are underway. Cross Ties Barbecue opening in downtown Carrboro. Drew Moore, owner and chef of Venable Rotisserie Bistro and B-Side Lounge in Carrboro, has taken over the lease at the former Station and the Tiger Room businesses near Carr Mill with plans to reopen as Cross Ties Barbecue. After some minor updates, Moore says the station will soon reopen as a bar and live music venue in March, and the former Tiger Room space will be converted into a smokehouse and prep kitchen for Cross Ties, which should be open by May. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Dental Acuity, How One Practitioner is Seizing Growth Opportunities. Sometimes when Dr. Michael Rickobean stops to think, it still surprises him that his dental practice has grown this large. I thought I would be that dentist with one pretty big office, he says. Instead, Rickobean Associates Family Dentistry will soon open two large specialty services practices to act like hubs for the 10 practices sprinkled throughout the eastern half of the triangle. Rickobean Associates now boasts 30 dentists and 190 employees, and Michael Rickobean has a long-range plan that would see the practice expand even more. The new hubs are set to open in the first half of this year, one in Cary at the intersection of High House and Maynard Roads in a former Blockbuster video store, and the other in Garner. The locations make sense as they split the Rickobean Associates' geographic footprint roughly in half to serve as the destination for specialty services from outlying practices. Rickobean invested $1.5 million in the Cary facility and $750,000 in the Garner location. While he won't divulge revenue figures for the practice, he says a good rule of thumb would see a practice record revenue of between $1 million and $1.5 million per dentist. A practice with 30 dentists is already on the high side compared to others around the state, but Rickobean Associates stands apart in another way as well. Michael Rickobean still controls 100% of the company, meaning all of the dentists are employees, not partners. Freshly minted dental graduates leave school with an average of $240,000 in debt, according to information from the NC Dental Society, and inexperienced dentists are now more willing to take positions as employees with a salary in order to pay down debt, a trend prevalent throughout other areas of healthcare as well. In some cases, as these dentists gain experience, they look to break out on their own and start their own practices. As they grow, however, these practices typically take on at least a few equity partners. In some dental practices, associates are paid in a structure heavy on incentives, but not at Rickobean. There, every dentist receives a salary, with the potential for some bonuses. Rickobean stresses this kind of structure because it allows everyone to work as a team focused on the patients. I want them to see patients and not dollar signs, he says. Fun fact, the dentistry's web address is brushandfloss.com. Rex Healthcare loses third exec to Orlando Health. Eric Hawkins has left UNC Rex Healthcare to take a senior vice president role with Orlando Health. He becomes the third UNC Rex executive to leave for Orlando Health after the Raleigh Hospital saw President David Strong and Chief Financial Officer Bernadette Spong leave this past summer. Hawkins had become the Rex CFO after Spong's departure. Rex, which has a long history in Raleigh, is owned by UNC Healthcare. Some executives split responsibilities at both Rex and the larger system. Coming on board with the UNC Healthcare system are Mark Miller as UNC Healthcare Senior Vice President of Finance, the position held by Spong, and Jeff Legay as UNC Rex Healthcare's interim CFO. Miller previously worked in the Novant Health System as Senior Vice President of Operational Finance and spent 10 years with Duke University Health System. Legay has served as Director of Corporate Finance at Rex for 4 years. Prior to joining Rex, he was employed at WakeMed Health and Hospitals for 10 years, serving in several positions. And in a section called They Said It, the quote, "We've become more excited about the deal. We're even more optimistic than when we initiated the deal." And that's from Dale Jenkins, CEO of Medical Mutual Insurance Company, which closed on an acquisition of the Pennsylvania-based Healthcare Providers Insurance Exchange, HPIX, book of business. The next quote, "Blood products are being delivered to hospitals as quickly as donations are coming in. Eligible donors are urged to make an appointment to give blood or platelets now and help ensure blood products are available for patients." And that's from Nick Gehrig, Communications Director, Red Cross Blood Services. "The American Red Cross has an emergency need for blood and platelet donors. Severe winter weather since January 1 has forced the cancellation of more than 300 blood drives across 20 states, resulting in more than 9,500 donations uncollected, further depleting an already low winter supply." And finally, in a section called Sports Business, Orange County wants to add a 50,000-square-foot indoor facility to the Orange County Sportplex with a multi-purpose field for soccer and other activities, two basketball courts, a fitness area, and other amenities. The project should cost no more than $3.8 million and will be funded by reserves and future revenue from the Sportsplex, which has been a profitable enterprise for the county and just recently celebrated its 10-year anniversary. With about 5,700 members, the Sportsplex generates around $3.7 million in revenue per year. Design-build firms interested in submitting qualifications for the project will meet with county officials on January 29 and submit qualifications by February 11. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. Peak 10 opens third Triangle Data Center. A newly opened data center could mean tax incentives for Charlotte-based Peak 10. Robbie Gauci, Vice President and General Manager of Peak 10's Triangle operation, confirms the company is trying to take advantage of a recently passed law that gives multi-tenant data center players the same tax exemptions that lured Facebook, Amazon, and Google to locate their data centers in the state. The Peak 10 Center officially opened this month, and while it currently only has about a 5% occupancy rate, Gauci says there's significant interest. "We've already got proposals out that could get us to 25% capacity," he says, declining to name current tenants. Peak 10 broke ground on the data center in May. The center, located off McCrimmon Parkway, is Peak 10's third in the Triangle area and ups the company's local presence to about 100,000 square feet. The Morrisville facility, dubbed Raleigh 3, contains 17,000 square feet of raised floor data center space, a dedicated disaster recovery work area for customers, and diverse redundant power feeds. Xerox confirms nearly 200 layoffs in Cary. 3 months after a top exec at Xerox confirmed it was exploring strategic options, the Connecticut-based technology giant has notified the state of North Carolina that it plans to lay off 178 employees at its Cary facility. "Unfortunately, we have made a difficult decision to close a unit dedicated to a single client at our Cary operations," reads a statement from Xerox. "Other units at the Cary facility will continue without interruption, We realize this affects individuals, and every effort is being made to ensure that all employees are treated fairly. Xerox spokesperson Coco Salazar says the unit provided customer care services for the unnamed client. All impacted employees have been notified and have the opportunity to apply for other positions within Xerox. According to the notice to the state, the layoffs are effective March 22. The majority of the jobs listed are customer care assistant positions. Supervisor roles are also included in the cuts. It's the latest headline for Xerox, which has been in a public state of transition for years, shifting from hardware such as printers, copiers, and ink to service-related areas such as document management. Shortly after reporting a $34 million quarterly net loss in October, company CEO Ursula Burns told investors that the board was reviewing structural options for the Xerox portfolio. Although we already have taken steps to accelerate cost reductions and prioritize investments to drive improved productivity and higher margins, our board determined that undertaking a comprehensive review of structural options for the company's portfolio is the right decision at this time, she said at the time. The company, which counts activist investor Carl Icahn as its second largest backer, Icahn Associates owned more than 8% of shares as of December, entered Cary in 2010 with the $6.4 billion purchase of Crescent Green Tenant Affiliated Computer Services. Xerox also has employees in Durham, Morrisville, Raleigh, Charlotte, and Henderson. Across the state, the company has more than 5,800 employees as of September. As of late last year, the company had nearly 1,500 employees in Cary, about 100 less than a total the company disclosed in August 2014. Xerox shares opened at $9.13 on January 26. Including the Xerox cuts, eight companies have notified North Carolina of layoffs thus far in 2016, potentially impacting more than 2,000 workers in the state. RDU passenger count up 4% in 2015. The numbers are in at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, and they show increased passenger activity in 2015, 443,170. That's how many in-plane passengers, less connections, trekked through RDU in September, nearly an 8% uptick from the same time period in 2014. RDU aircraft in-planed 6.9 million pounds of cargo during that same December time period, and 94.2 million pounds during the 2015 calendar year, and 172,783 vehicles exited public parking lots, with 21,490 taxi trips reported at RDU in December. For the full year, that's 1.9 million exiting vehicles and nearly 330,000 taxi trips. Of the flights taking off from RDU in December, a whopping 28.8% were Delta, trailed by Southwest at 24.5%, U.S. Airways at 14.1%, American at 11.9%, and United at 11.9%. Including connections, RDU saw 445,957 passengers in December. For the calendar year, that's 4,987,585 passengers, or 4,957,449 without connections. That's more than a 4% increase over 2014's passenger count. And now we'll turn to a special section of this edition of Triangle Business Journal, the SPACE, Commercial Real Estate Quarterly, for the fourth quarter of 2015. And we'll read the main article, which is headlined, Build Relationships, Then Projects. Carter Worthy's career includes years of community service. And Carter Worthy is the winner of the 2016 Pillar Award for Leadership. This article is written by Amanda Hoyle. In the 20 years since Carter Worthy started her own independent commercial real estate brokerage firm in Raleigh, many in the industry have crowned her the Queen of Nonprofits for all the work she'd done to help the Triangle's most needy agencies and causes. Worthy has helped Habitat for Humanity of Way County find land for new houses and guided the group through the process of finding property and building a new, bigger Habitat Reuse Center in 2007. And the new Dress for Success Triangle Boutique shop and warehouse that's moved to Tillery Place, north of downtown Raleigh. Worthy helped put that deal together as well. Worthy says she's lost count of all the Triangle charities, nonprofits, political candidates, and loyal friends who have come to her with their real estate questions and needs over the years. I was intentional when I started my business that I wanted to either pursue a relationship or something that was a community cause, she says. I had already seen that there are a lot of nonprofits out there with real estate issues, and I already saw that as an angle for community service. It took her a bit longer, she says, to see it also as an angle for making money and actually making a living. Sometimes it's better to just be a volunteer, and I do a lot of that, she says. Other times it's clear that this nonprofit needs a real estate professional to help them all the way from start to finish, and there is going to be a fee in the transaction. It's a little tricky sometimes, but for me, it's worked out pretty well. Carter Worthy Commercial has never had more than two or three employees and currently shares an office in the historic Mahler Building on Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh with real estate appraisal firm Hester & Company, owned by Worthy's husband, Tom Hester. The couple are part owners of the building, as well as several other historic buildings in the downtown core that are home to Ashley Christensen's Jewel Restaurant and Coffee Shop, King's Barcade, and the Mahler Fine Art Gallery. Champion for Raleigh. Worthy, over the years, has also had a hand in helping shape policy and plans for redevelopment and amenities through her Raleigh hometown. She served on the Raleigh Parks and Recreation Advocacy Committee in 2015 that lobbied for a $92 million bond referendum that was approved by 68% of voters, and she served in 2003 on the successful bond campaign to invest another $450 million in Wake County public school projects. In 2001, Worthy was appointed by then-Raleigh Mayor Charles Meeker to co-chair the Fayetteville Street Visioning Committee that gathered input and made the initial recommendation to the City Council to reopen Fayetteville Street Mall to vehicular traffic. It was a $10 million investment by the city that has since attracted millions more in private capital investment in the form of new office towers and improvements to existing buildings that have brought in new companies, restaurants, retailers, and more workers to the downtown core. As chairwoman of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance in 2009, she championed the launch of the city's free downtown circulator bus system, the R Line, and the opening of the Holiday Ice Rink as part of the city's annual Winterfest celebration. Challenges along the way. But not everything has always gone Worthy's way. She had a failed bid for a state senate seat in 2004 when she came in third behind then city council member Janet Cowell, who later went on to become state treasurer. Worthy also served 2 years as a chair of the Triangle Transit Authority Board during a challenging time in 2006 when federal funding for a 28-mile regional rail project for the Triangle was first approved and later rescinded by the Federal Transit Administration. I worked on that for 7 years, and we came up short, she says. I am heartened that Wake County's probably going to have a transit referendum this year. I'm optimistic that the will of the people is that we will have transit here and will approve that. A growing city like Raleigh has got to have transit. A true generalist. As for her company, Worthy says she'll keep doing what she's been doing, helping loyal clients who have become friends like Raleigh real estate developers Frank Gaylor and Roland Gammon and Raleigh businessman Dean Debman. I always was and still am a generalist, Worthy says. Leases, sales, land, site selection, you name it. My niche more so than product type has been a relationship type. Get a good personal relationship and stick with it. And a closer look at Carter Worthy. Title, President of Carter Worthy Commercial of Raleigh. Family, husband, Tom Hester, sons, Thomas, 24, and Ford, 17. Education, UNC Chapel Hill, with a bachelor's degree in American Studies. Designation as a certified commercial investment member. Community involvement. trustee of John Rex Endowment and City of Oaks Foundation, board member of Triangle Community Foundation's Real Estate Foundation, past chair of Downtown Raleigh Alliance, Triangle Transit Authority, Friends of the City of Raleigh Museum, Raleigh Zoning Board of Adjustment, past member of the City of Raleigh Public Art and Design Board, Wake Education Partnership, Raleigh Hall of Fame Selection Committee, Wake County Boys and Girls Club, Friends of the North Carolina Natural Sciences Museum, Raleigh Parks Bond Committee in 2015, 2010 Honorary Chair of the Visual Art Exchange Gala, and more. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, and we'll start with the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Winning Cures Many Ails for Pro Sports Franchises. What makes the Panthers' run to the Super Bowl unprecedented is the fact that so many sports analysts, broadcasters, and sometimes players from other teams thought the Panthers were overrated and the team was primed for losses to so-called better teams. Well, that did not happen, and the Panthers kept on winning and winning and winning. Anyone who has visited Charlotte in the past couple of weeks will tell you the city has gone mad. Residents have always loved their football team, but this year is special. They're going to the Super Bowl as the favorite against the Denver Broncos. On February 7, North Carolina may have its second top-tier professional sports team win it all. The first, of course, were the Carolina Hurricanes in 2006 when they hoisted the Stanley Cup. And that's where I pivot and talk about how on-the-field and on-the-ice performances remain the ultimate cure for an ailing franchise. In this space, in the past months, I have talked about the plight of the Hurricanes and how we as a community must find a way to support the hockey club. I also talked about how the Canes have to reach out to the community and make noticeable concessions to get fans through the turnstiles. Almost everyone I talked to since the last column agreed that both things must happen. Then came December 26. Playing at home, the Hurricanes beat the New Jersey Devils 3-1 in front of an announced crowd of 11,654. Generally speaking, the actual number is far fewer than the announced crowd. But the winning has not really stopped since then. The Hurricanes finished January with a 7-3-3 record that has put the team in the playoff hunt. In contrast, the Hurricanes won 3 games in November and lost 10, including overtime and shootout losses. But when the team starts winning, do more people show up at games? You betcha. Don Waddell, president of Gale Force Sports, the parent company of the Carolina Hurricanes, says the team has averaged 12,089 in paid attendance for the past 10 home games that included 2 games with snow in the parking lot. The team averaged 10,189 through most of December this season. The 20% increase in attendance was not due to the new suits Waddell got for Christmas or general manager Ron Francis's new holiday haircut. It was because the team started winning. Fans like winning, and the community will support the team in ways even the team management can't imagine if the team wins consistently. The Panthers did it this year. Now it's time for the Canes. We are off to a great start in 2016. And continuing on the Viewpoint page, we'll read the viewpoint of John Hood, who is the president of the Pope Foundation in Raleigh. The headline on his Viewpoint column, Ways to Understand Reasons for Job Growth. Few political promises are as common as this one. My policies will create jobs. You hear it from candidates for federal, state, and local office, as well as from activists, commentators, and other political actors. Generally speaking, those on the right tend to emphasize the government policies they believe inhibit job creation, such as high taxes and heavy regulations. Generally speaking, those on the left tend to emphasize the government expenditures they believe enhance job creation on education, infrastructure, and even public assistance programs such as Medicaid and unemployment insurance. This debate has been going on for a very long time. It won't be resolved anytime soon. Why? One reason is that employment growth is the product of many factors, some controlled by governments, but most determined by forces politicians can't control, no matter how hard they try. For example, no government policy, or at least no policy sustainable in a free society, could possibly have prevented the automobile from displacing the horse and buggy as the primary means of personal mobility. Other inventions and innovations have produced similarly disruptive change since then, across many economic sectors. Because states began with differing concentrations of the displaced industries, they've experienced differing rates of net employment growth. Even when we limit our focus to public policy, both conservatives and liberals have plausible cases to make for their respective priorities for promoting job creation. It makes sense that, all other things being equal, businesses are more likely to be founded, sustained, and expanded in places where the costs of doing business are lower. But it also makes sense that, all other things being equal, businesses are more likely to be founded, sustained, and expanded in places where traffic moves more freely on good roads and the pool of potential workers, professionals, and entrepreneurs is better educated. The idea that job creation is higher in places with more generous public assistance programs is far less plausible, and indeed clearly contradicted by the vast majority of scholarly studies of the subject. If politicians tell you otherwise, it would be entirely reasonable to conclude they are either woefully uninformed or actively trying to mislead you. I constantly scan for new academic research on job creation because, yes, I'm just that nerdy. The latest study I've read will soon be published in Applied Economic Letters, a scholarly journal. Jacksonville University economist Richard Sebula and three of his colleagues explored state-by-state differences in net job creation from the turn of the century to the onset of the Great Recession in 2007. Specifically, they wanted to see which of the following variables showed a statistically significant relationship with state employment growth. 1. The state's average cost of living for a family of 4. 2. The average January temperature. 3. The average effective income tax rate. 4. The share of workers belonging to unions. 5. The share of those aged 25 and older with at least a high school diploma. And 6. The net percentage growth rate in the number of small businesses in the state. So which of these factors made a difference? All of them. The study's findings suggest that people tend to move to warmer places with lower costs of living, including taxes, thus supplying more labor to potential employers. Businesses, in turn, tend to start in or relocate to lower-cost jurisdictions with access to educated workers that can be employed at competitive rates, i.e., at rates not kept artificially high by unionization. The effects are particularly pronounced among the small companies that tend to create a disproportionate number of net new jobs. These six factors explain about half of all the variation in state job growth rates. Here in North Carolina, conservatives would say their policies are making the state more attractive in five of them: taxes, cost of living, unionization, education attainment, and entrepreneurship. And for our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of this news article headlined, U.S. likely to play muted role in any GSK CEO search. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. Don't expect Research Triangle Park to play a big role in any search for a GSK chief executive. Rumors out of the United Kingdom swirled that pharma giant GlaxoSmithKline will look to replace its CEO, Andrew Witty. However, even though the global company operates a consequential hub and employs thousands of workers in North Carolina, don't expect this area, or really any operations in the United States, to play a major role in hiring a new CEO, should the company move in that direction. For starters, the company's shareholders and largest investors are concentrated in London. GSK has nearly 4.9 billion shares outstanding traded on the London Stock Exchange, exactly double the number of shares outstanding on the New York Stock Exchange that trades as American Depository Receipts, or ADRs. For the shares on the London Exchange, 135 listed institutional shareholders who control more than 31% of the shares are concentrated in London, according to data pulled from FactSet Research Systems Incorporated. By comparison, institutional shareholders in Los Angeles, New York, and Philadelphia combined comprise 79 shareholders who control 8% of shares. For the ADRs traded on the New York Exchange, shareholders from New York, Boston, Los Angeles, Portland, and Baltimore, Washington, D.C., combined to control slightly more than 5%. When it comes to the board of directors, however, GSK has more intercontinental balance. Of the 16 directors, 7 are British and 6 are American. The board also includes a Swiss and 2 Dutch directors, CEO Witte and CFO Simon Dingmans, who both have board seats, are British. Just because the majority of major shareholders hail from the United Kingdom doesn't mean some shareholders stateside aren't applying pressure. A report in the Sunday Times reported that Ock Ziff Capital Management, an American hedge fund, took a secret stake in GSK and is cranking up pressure on Witte. Separately, though connected, shareholders have been calling for GSK to split. Especially with the integration of assets acquired from Novartis, GSK has rather large business units that investors argue could do better as standalone companies. At the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference earlier this month, Witte indicated he would consider breaking off the consumer healthcare division, though such a move wouldn't happen for years, if at all. From a sales perspective, the United States matters a great deal to GSK. About 1/3 of the company's total revenue comes from this country. And finally, the spotlight in the People on the Move section is on David Zimmerman, president of First Citizens Investor Services. Armed with more than 3 decades of experience in the financial services industry, David Zimmerman has stepped into a new role as president of First Citizens Investor Services. And we will stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.